So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
We take you now, ladies and gentlemen, to a Cuban immigrant, an individual who apparently feels as though the streets of America are paved with gold. Here is Razor Ramon.
Ramon. Razor Ramon. I come from the gutter. I know that. I got no education. Who needs it? Look at me. Look at me. Look at the gold. Look at my clothes. I'm a success. I'm coming to the WWF. All I want, what I got coming to me. The world, chico. Everything in it.
Yeah, chico. Something said a bad guy. Yeah, chico. Yeah, chico. Something said a bad guy. Toothpick in your eye. I'm that guy. Hey, y'all. Good. Something happened to thee. Something happened to you, okay? Hey, y'all. Don't look like no Daniel B where they seeing me as a goat. Hey, yo. Something happened to me, something happened to you.
Welcome to Review Away. It's Friday, and Wei Ting is with me. Wei, you and I have never spoken before on a Friday. Ever.
This is weird.
Whoa. You're really laid back on Fridays.
Yeah, usually I'm like, you know, in shorts and a tank top. My weekend's just already started.
Yeah, man.
I'm like, I'm usually just cracking open a beer at work. I'll just, you know.
Oh, boy.
I'll probably just be in my underwear normally, but at work on a Friday. But not today. Today.
Man, you got all dressed up.
I'm like in
your vintage Toronto Blue Jays shirt from 8-year-old Wei Ting's closet.
Yeah, I got all dressed up. I'm in pants. And
no, you're not.
I'm drinking water.
Very appropriate. Very professional of you.
Fridays, yes. Fridays is the new day.
Weigh the question on everyone's mind.
Yep.
Are you sick of talking to me yet this week? You and I have spent 3 hours already this week.
No.
Talking about Raw and SmackDown. And now we're going to chat about Scott Hall.
Yeah, I know. No, I'm not. I'm not sick because, like, all the things we've... It's been a very newsworthy week, and I've actually enjoyed talking about all these things. So
you have also... This has to be your record for the amount of shows you've done in a week, because you also did CW Scene with Braden.
Correct, yes.
So 2.5 podcasts you've done this week.
Yeah, I suppose
now
so.
Now 3.5.
I suppose so. I mean, I'm trying to keep up with you, man. I think you still got me beat. For sure.
It's kind of close. I mean, if you count your CWC one as a separate one, that makes up for the MMA report. We're equal, dude.
Yeah, but what if you include your G1 podcast? That takes you...
They're not full shows. Those are little updates.
Takes you way over the top. Plus your appearances on The Law. Come on.
Well, you're getting damn close, Wei.
I don't know if I want to be. I don't think I want to be.
Well, this is a sacrifice you made in life, Wei, by befriending me. If only you could go back in time.
This guy dragged me into this. I was a call screener. I wasn't supposed to talk.
Wait, we said earlier this week that we're going to be giving away a Scott Hall DVD.
Yes.
How are we going to do this?
You and I were kind of batting around some ideas for contests, and we love any time we do a contest because our listeners are very creative and they always come through. We have a number of options, actually. Do you want to go with the one that we discussed earlier?
I think I know what you're talking about. That sounds good.
Okay. So, you know, we've been doing Review of Raw for a while, and we are looking for, man.
Free content.
Let's think about this. Let's think about this.
Let's think it out loud.
Do you want to keep doing, like, the secret question thing? Or should we replace that with this?
I'm not married to it.
Yeah, okay.
Let's ditch it.
So maybe we should announce, we should change up the secret question thing and turn this contest into the free t-shirt giveaway.
Sure. They're agreeing. They're agreeing. Everyone's nodding their head in agreement that's listening to this. So, secret question out on the TV version of Reviewer Raw.
Yeah.
And in comes what?
This won't be for the DVD then.
Oh, boy.
The DVD will have to be a separate.
Oh, okay. I understand. Okay, let's save that for that.
Let's cut
to okay,
this
whole no, 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 no.
We're not including
no,
any of
wait.
This, man.
People want all access, okay?
Oh, God.
So, for the Scott Hall DVD, let's come up with a clever way to give this out. I don't want to do the secret word thing.
No.
I want to do something more, something that requires some work.
Well, I'll tell you, now that we're doing a review of SmackDown, we are somewhat in need of a theme song.
Whoa. Okay. You want to go there. Well, I'm going to up the stakes then. If we're going to do a theme song contest for SmackDown, first of all, it's got to be good. I'm not just going to pick the best of some awful versions. It's got to be like what we've got on Reveal Raw. That's an excellent theme song.
The standard that Colby John has set?
Colby set a high standard, and we got to maintain that. Let's do a theme song contest. We'll give some people some time to compose this. And if you win, you will get a Scott Hall DVD, but you're also going to get a WrestleMania DVD and the best of the Attitude Era Volume 3, in which I just got 10 copies of under my desk.
Whoa!
You're actually knocking into them.
Okay, wow. And three DVDs.
Three DVDs. It's like 9 discs.
Maybe even a Fight Network shirt.
If we've got them.
And our eternal gratitude.
Well, your song will be immortalized on Review of SmackDown.
Gotcha.
And honestly, if Colby John is more than allowed to enter this, okay?
I feel like we're probably discouraging a lot of people from entering.
No,
the standard is set so high.
All right, we'll shoot for the stars. That's what I want.
Yeah. See, I feel like whatever selections we get, I feel like we need a departure from what the Raw themes review of Raw theme song sounds like.
Oh, you're disqualifying Colby then.
Not necessarily.
You want a different sound.
If Colby wants to, like, you know, all of a sudden become a rapper or something like that, maybe we'll
agree. Well, here's the deal. If your song is great, there's nothing preventing us from doing a rotation of songs as
yes,
well.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe we got to make a review of SmackDown have its own feel.
Exactly.
Like, maybe we have an extra song.
Whoa, that's a wild idea.
Yeah.
Like a sing-along at the end of the show?
Maybe it's an instrumental. Maybe it's
God.
It's hardcore rap.
Yeah. Well, maybe I like the idea of a rotation of songs, too. So maybe if you have a really bad song, at some point we might play that one.
Yeah.
And anyway, I feel like because this is Review of SmackDown for the time being will remain an audio-only show, and thus I feel like we have a bit more freedom to just play or no copyright restrictions. We'll just kind of play the craziest ideas that you guys have.
Our programming team actually approached me today.
Oh, did they? Are we putting it on air?
They said, saw that you guys did a review of SmackDown. It's like, yeah. Any ideas of maybe, I said, not right now.
Not right now. We don't, honestly, like, if a lot of, listen, I know some of you are disappointed that, like, Review Away and Byron Pollock are only going to be once every 2 weeks. This was only, you know, honestly, it had to be done.
It was either bi-weekly or it was bye-bye.
Yeah, but if SmackDown really sucks.
We'll bail.
Yeah,
we will cut bait.
Switch back. Yeah.
Okay? We're not tied to any of this.
No.
But I'll tell you this, folks. There is not an extra hour of talking I can possibly provide at this point.
Yeah.
I always tell away, my paranoia is just people do not want to hear any goddamn more of me.
No, that's not true. I don't
want to hear more of me.
Well, I think you're very hard on yourself,
well,
which I don't
just,
think you need to be.
Come on, for Christ's sake. It's just...
Anyway, so, yeah, we will... let's open that up right now.
Yes, it is open, and let's give people some time.
Yeah.
We'll give a few weeks
two weeks.
Okay,
or
2 weeks.
Maybe we'll announce the winner. Not this coming up, coming review of SmackDown. We'll do it the following review of SmackDown. So that date is August 2nd.
All right.
So let's say the cutoff, August 1st.
Okay, August 1st. That's enough time for people? I think so. Okay.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's the contest. And yes, if you win, We've got DVDs to spare in this one, so you'll win big if you are chosen. And if we pick a number of them...
DVDs.
Not everyone's going to get three. The winner will get three, and we might have some... We'll have something for if you are chosen for anything, but it's mainly the winner, though.
How about DVDs and a hand written...
Didn't know where you were going with that.
A handwritten, maybe a...
No.
Poem.
A French vanilla.
No.
You have to come pick it up.
Not doing that.
Okay. It's time to live on the razor's edge. The Scott Hall story. The recent DVD that the WWE has released. And Scott Hall, first of all, I think a great subject. This guy is a tremendous speaker, a tremendous storyteller. How do you feel Scott Hall comes off just as a subject?
Came across like somebody who... seemed incredibly honest, first of all. I'd say, you know, came across honest. Like, we always have to keep in mind that we're seeing on-air versions of, you know,
yes.
people. Whether or not...
And Scott Hall is one of those guys.
I don't know. I've never met the guy in person. I don't know. But I'm just saying, as a viewer of anything, as a listener of these shows, you might hear me and think, oh, this guy might be like this in person. Well, I'm not. This is a fake version of me that I'm doing this review.
You're a worker.
I'm working so hard. But anyway, in the case of Scott Hall, I think, I don't know, but I'm just saying he comes across as somebody who seems very genuine, very honest about his faults, and somebody who doesn't have much of an ego, obviously, to protect, you know, any type of, image. That he has anymore. He's completely honest about his mistakes in his past, and he owns up to everything.
Yeah, and again, I don't know Scott Hall, but I watch him, and I think he's someone that's willing to put everything on the table about himself, good and bad. But he's one of those guys where you do get the impression he's very aware when the camera is on. And that goes for many, many guys, especially of that generation.
I think that goes for every wrestler. It's a skill that they should have. If you want to be successful in pro wrestling, it's a skill that I wish more MMA fighters had.
Well, it started in the parking lot, and they would go back to this later. And this came out in the ESPN feature that they did on Scott Hall a number of years back, where it came out that he had, in fact, killed a man during the struggle with a gun, and linking that to all of the problems that Scott Hall has had and getting over that massive incident in his life. And... he goes to start talking and has to cut himself off during the on-camera spot discussing this, just not being able to do it. And it was a very strange scene where it's all taped up anyway from another incident that happened in this parking lot when they went to go shoot this.
Yeah, they just happened to go to the same location of his initial traumatic event.
The dollhouse.
The dollhouse on the day of a police investigation. So it... I mean, if the producer or the director of this documentary probably was really happy about that. Oh, wow. Police tape. Nice. Let's use it. But I thought I think it goes to show, again, just how the higher level of production that these WWE documentaries have gone up to, I would say ever since the CM Punk DVD, where they, you know, have a day where they take the subject out of the room and focus on a setting relevant to their history. And they use these as bumpers and breaks throughout their traditional chronologic storytelling in the documentary.
Yeah, and I was looking forward to watching this, but I was also really hoping they'd have many different angles to Scott Hall, because the last thing I wanted was 15 minutes on the ladder match with Sean and 15 minutes on the NWO and the big... No, like I did not need anything more on those
topics that have already been covered,
exhausted to death.
In other DVDs,
yes, and I think obviously have to touch on those, but I didn't think they ever just hit you over the head with topics that we literally got a Monday Night War series on that, and we didn't have to keep going there.
They seem very aware of not doubling up on topics they've already covered, and again, much like the Bischoff DVD, it felt like they were producing these documentaries for people who already knew much of the history of what they were talking about.
And they certainly went outside of just colleagues of Scott's. We saw Pat Hall, his mother, being interviewed. and discussing how Scott was born in Maryland and his father was in the army, and they showed all the different places he moved around, and including Germany as well. And they showed some of these teenage photos of Scott Hall that were just priceless.
He looked totally different. He was like much thinner at the time. But yeah, like good-looking kid, looks very different from how he ended up.
And one of the guys that was all over this was his brother, Steve Hall, who looks shockingly similar to Cody Hall, Scott's son. And Steve's a cop, and he was used throughout all of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In cop uniform.
In his uniform, yes. Yeah. So there you have it. And Scott noted how he decided at the age of 8 that he wanted to be a pro wrestler and grew up a big fan of Dusty Rhodes, watching Florida Championship Wrestling, which he had always cited as a big influence on him, and then, of course, getting to work with him in World Championship Wrestling. And then you go to when he became a bouncer at a nightclub and then worked at a strip club. And that's where we get the scene of how this murder occurred. It was in January of 1983, and he described how he was dating this girl who worked at the strip club, and he showed up one night, and a gun was pulled on him, and they were doing the recreation as well.
Yeah.
This was like something out of like Cops or...
No, not Cops. You're thinking of, what is it?
Rescue 911?
America's Most Wanted.
America's Most Wanted, yeah. Yes. So they're doing that, and he says how he ended up killing the guy. He shot him in the head during this struggle, and he got charged with second-degree murder. And they showed this newspaper clipping of the time, and they didn't go into the details, but I paused it to read it.
Yeah, me too.
And so the weapon was a .45 caliber handgun, and Hall had been dating the victim's wife. And the newspaper also noted that the victim had fatally shot a man for making advances at his wife earlier, a few months prior. And the killing was ruled justifiable. Scott was 24 at the time and ended up being cleared of all charges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just...
Because the documentary doesn't actually point out, like, the connection of the girlfriend to the guy who ended up getting shot and why he... Oh, I guess they did... Did he actually talk about that, or was that just in the newspaper clipping?
Maybe in passing. Right. But,
anyway, that was the context of the
idea,
struggle.
The idea was to basically show this guy... Scott Hall was involved in a man's killing and was charged with second-degree murder, and this led to... a trial.
This was, yeah, and a massive traumatic event that Scott Hall believes everything became a symptom of. And he later discussed this, you know, his drinking problems, that was all the byproduct that tied itself back to this really dark event that happened in his life and getting over the guilt of that.
It doesn't get into specifics of this incident, and I don't know how much they really... information they really had to kind of show it. Like, this show is not... making a murderer, you know what I mean? Like, not that level of death. They more just so pointed out that this happened to this guy, and, you know, here's the aftermath of it.
And they talked to his mother, who feels this event changed his entire life. He never ended up getting past it. And we kind of just leave it at that, and then would come back to it later on during all of his personal problems and getting over those. But we go back to professional wrestling, and it was when he was just working at gyms that he ended up meeting Kevin Sullivan, and Kevin Sullivan was interviewed for this. Jake Roberts was interviewed for this.
Dusty was interviewed for this.
Yeah, we had old clips of Dusty as well.
I mean, I wonder how long they were working on this documentary, because this Dusty interview looked like it took place like in the Performance Center. I would say one of the probably more last interviews I imagine Dusty gave to the WWE. But it had him talking about Scott Hall extensively.
Yeah, and we heard from Shawn Michaels discussing how he first met Scott working in Kansas City, and Hall teaming with Dan Spivey, the future Waylon Mercy, as American Starship.
Yes.
Great Can't name. Miss, written all over it.
Great name.
American Starship. And Hall knew that he had the look, and they were all describing how he looked so similar to Tom Selleck at the time with the big mustache and the big curly hair. And it was Dusty Rhodes who ended up buying Scott Hall his very first pair of boots.
That's just such a great story.
about buying his boots.
Yeah, when Hall couldn't afford them himself. And then Hall goes on to talk about a great moment he had later when he was finally making money and got the chance to pay Dusty back, and how good it made him feel to pay his friends back.
There's a great line by Blackjack Lanza when Scott was working in the AWA. He had hooked up with Diamond Dallas Page, and Lanza spotted him and said, "He can wrestle a little bit, but what he has is the perception of entertainment. He's bigger than life." When Lanza was a road agent in the AWA and spotting the fact that, okay, not the world's greatest worker here, but this guy has a dynamite look, which he certainly did in the mid-80s, that could easily transfer itself over to one of the larger companies when the AWA was, you know, as the 80s progressed, was certainly dwindling.
I find it amusing that they thought his look was so great at the time, when I think we can all look back at that version of Big Scott Hall and just laugh, especially considering how he ended up looking as Razor Ramon.
Yeah, I mean, you did in the WWF, where, God, the guys were just so huge at the time. I mean, Scott Hall didn't jump out at you as a giant, but
he had slimmed down considerably, though.
Yeah, but in this time, in the AWA, he had the jacked-up shoulders, yeah. And, I mean, was just huge next to some of the guys he was working with there. And he talked about teaming with Kurt Hennig in the AWA and how much Kurt taught him and approaching this like it's a business. And certainly you can see a lot of influence Kurt Hennig had on his peers at the time and kind of the business side of the industry.
Yeah, Hall gives Kurt Hennig a lot of credit for basically carrying him in a lot of their tag team matches. He would say that Kurt would do the bulk of the work in the match, and then he'd reach out for the hot tag and just basically let Hall get the pin. And he called Kurt Hennig one of the most unselfish people he's ever met. And I could say the same, you know, by how much Scott Hall in this documentary credits other people, you could see the same in Scott Hall.
Some of the best parts of this documentary to me were not so much even the sit-down interviews with Scott, but it was him conversing with the NXT talent, where they had brought him into the Performance Center, and he's giving them tips, and they're seated around a ring, and it's Scott just talking about different elements of his career, and he's talking to them about how he didn't drink at first when he was in the AWA, and it gave the perception to others of him being stuck up when he wouldn't drink. And finally, one day, someone telling him, like a lot of the
Kurt Hennig
telling him, a lot of business gets done at the bar and learning the social aspect of things. And yeah, you look at Scott Hall as someone that, you know, says he never drank and what that would escalate into. Mm-hmm. But I found a lot of these just conversations very natural with the younger talent. And he just seemed, in every shot they showed of him, just loved working with these younger people and just hearing little gems from him that were interspersed throughout the documentary. Mm-hmm. Then we had Shawn Michaels, who was explaining the mentality that guys like him and the Click had at the time, and it was the idea that the business and the promoters, everyone was against them, and they had to rally together and kind of fight the system, and that was kind of a common bond that they all had. And Scott was discussing how he was ready to quit the business at one point and go work at Sears and learn how to work a forklift. What could have been. And he pitched the Diamond Stud idea to Diamond Dallas Page, who ended up getting him into WCW. And it was Page who came up with the idea of dyeing his hair jet black and having the stubble and the toothpick. And Page just essentially coming up with this character for him.
Coming up with the Razor Ramon look.
Yeah, the look under a different name in WCW, and then adding the accent and everything in WWF. But it was also in WCW where he first met Kevin Nash. They would go to the gym together, and they were in the mid-card, and Hall was constantly calling the WWF to pitch Pat Patterson on hiring him. And finally he got the call back from Patterson, and they were asking him if he had signed a contract with WCW, and he had just signed a one-year deal. And Patterson told him that a year from now, come calling, and there should be a door open for you. So he would spend a year in WCW.
Yeah, so do you think that would have made any difference on his career if he had come in a year earlier in that environment? What was it, like 91?
Yeah, it would have been, you know, mid-91 coming in. It's hard to say. I mean, in 92, you had so many guys that left for various reasons, like Hogan, who disappeared, and Sid, and Piper. You had all these guys leave that had allowed Ramon to come in, mm-hmm. in a top heel spot,
yeah.
that I don't know if that top spot would have been available to him if you had a number of those other guys that were still around at that point a year earlier. So it turned out to be a good time for him to come in 92, and he was instantly a main eventer during his first few months there.
Mm-hmm.
So he did this WWF dark match in Louisville in black trunks with red knee pads. His gear looked awful here in this dark match that they had.
Very generic.
But it's awesome that they have this footage.
So great. I mean, and again, like, I think that there's something to be said about, you know, these DVDs and how far they've come from. They were very good, like, even in, you know, the early 2000s when they started doing a lot of these. They were always very good. But now they're just at such a different level because they have everything you... They had everything that was ever recorded, seemingly, of this guy in a wrestling ring, from his AWA stuff to his WCW stuff, to even a dark match in the WWF.
Yeah, and he discusses coming up with the character with Vince McMahon, and Vince was just trying to find something that Scott Hall could really associate himself with. And he talked about his dad being in the Army and Scott Hall having the fear of just being an Army Ranger or something on the show.
Because this was the time when Vince was... you know, taking one quality of a guy and turning it into his complete identity.
He could have been Sergeant Slaughter's understudy. But instead, he pitched him on the Scarface movie and Al Pacino's character.
Vince asked him what his favorite movie was.
Yeah, he said Scarface, and Vince had never heard of it. And he was telling him about Tony Montana, and that took us into the vignettes, which were tremendous vignettes at the time.
All of them on the DVD as bonus features, by the way.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They put all of those on as well. And I remember when these first aired, I mean, you just saw this guy as just this ultimate badass that was coming in that you knew was going to be a big deal. And these vignettes were great. Tossing guys in the water fountains. Yeah.
See, like, I was, obviously, I was, like, what, like, 8 at the time? And I don't know. I mean, obviously, I hadn't seen Scarface at the age of 8. But I wonder, please let us know if you're an older member of the audience and if the connections to Scarface were that apparent immediately.
Oh, I didn't know what Scarface was when this aired. So as far as I was concerned, it was Tony Montana ripping off Scott Hall when I first saw the movie.
Because, like, you know, as a kid watching this, you just kind of see this guy who seems like a bit of a dick, and you don't really know what to make of it because he's kind of got a weird accent that, you know, is... I think we can all see Tony Montana in the Razor Ramon character, but it's not necessarily an accent that you would immediately identify as Scarface, you know?
I remember, like, he would have the razor blades as his logo.
Yeah.
I had never seen those before in my life when I was 8 years old,
yeah.
and I didn't know what they were.
Yeah.
And he'd always talk about his machismo, and I thought they were pieces of cheese because they were always, like, yellow. They were these, like, yellow-colored razor blades. And I was like, is that, like, his cheese? Is that, like, something? And I had no idea.
I'm oozing cheese?
Yeah, that's what I thought. And I was like, man, this is gross, kind of. But then I would learn what razor blades were. But I had never seen a razor blade in my life when I was 8.
But immediately, it was clear that they hit on something that really worked. And it wasn't as corny as, say, like a Big Boss Man. You know, it was a ripoff of Tony Montana, but it also had its own spin to it that made it somewhat unique and original. And I'm amazed that it was such a departure from Big Scott Hall. And not just in the way he looked, but in the way he dressed, in the way he spoke. I mean, as far as I know, Hall is not any part Latino or Cuban. So, you know, to go from guy with a big mustache, wearing cowboy boots, to this is such a departure, but he was also so captivating doing this, you know?
He was such a, like, he made this character. This character could have been a giant flop with the wrong person.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been just a Tony Montana awful parody.
Mm-hmm.
It could have so easily become that. This guy was so great in this role.
But you give a lot of credit to the vignettes that Vince McMahon helped produce, and we saw some footage of that here, some great behind-the-scenes footage of Vince on set for these vignettes coaching Scott Hall, talking about how, you know, telling him to, like, I forget the specific direction, but it shows you that Vince was probably, like, behind the scenes for almost all these things, the Mr. Perfect vignettes, all this stuff. It was probably Vince back there directing. And so I think there have been instances where you might kind of criticize Vince McMahon for simplifying a wrestler too much, like Ray Traylor. What do you do? I'm a correctional officer. Okay, let's make you a cop.
You're a big correctional officer.
But, you know, in this case, it seemed to work out.
Yeah. So the vignettes were a big hit, and then they showed his debut in August of 92 on Superstars. Howard Finkel doing an awesome intro, rolling the R's. And I always remembered the, you know, he'd hand the gold off to the guy at ringside. Yeah. And the first time I ever heard it, where he's just saying, you know, something happens to this gold, something's going to happen to you. And it was almost as if, it's not like the guy was mic'd, and it's almost like you eavesdropped on this. It's like, this dude's really serious about his gold here, and you better not fuck around.
I was eight, and like my friends and I were quoting that specific line to each other in the playground. And again, I think it just like shows you how much that was unique to this character, that I don't know who came up with that line, but those are things that really, you know, sticks with you.
So they don't spend too much time, I mean, kind of going through the early days of the character, but of course they showed a little bit about, you know, headlining the Royal Rumble against Bret Hart, and they even showed footage of him going into the Arco Arena in Sacramento the night before the match with Bret, and he's wearing this Minnesota Timberwolves jacket, which I can only assume is who Sacramento was playing that night, and he's just cutting a wrestling promo to the whole crowd at the NBA arena.
Yes.
That was great. And then we just fast forward to the babyface turn in the spring of 93 with the 1-2-3 Kid, which was really put Raw on the map. That was one of the big matches early on in the first year of the show, was the 1-2-3 Kid, who they had seen. Of course, he had been on Global, but if you had only seen WWF, I mean, had done a number of jobs, and then beats this guy out of nowhere. That was a big upset at the time, and they played it up gigantic.
I would like go as far to say as one of maybe the most memorable, you know, matches of that type. One of the most memorable upsets the WWE probably has ever had, because it ended up certainly working out really well. I mean, pretty well for the 1-2-3 Kid. I don't know if Sean Waltman would even be talked about today. I don't know if X-Pac would have ever happened had he not, you know, had this initial push. And Waltman was interviewed saying how Hall was immediately cool with it because he understood the business. And Hall says it's not about winning or losing, it's about performing.
Yeah, which, I mean, there's probably a lot of guys that would not have gone for this. Losing to a guy the size of Sean Waltman on TV like that, it was certainly risky if you're Scott Hall and doing something like that. And he ended up coming out of it a pretty strong babyface when everything was said and done by the summer that year, and feuding with Ted DiBiase and then getting thrust into the IC title picture, which was the next chapter of his WWF career, was when Shawn Michaels was stripped of the title and he was off television, and Hall won the vacant title, beating Rick Martel in the finals. And then we got Shawn Michaels making his return, and we got a cameo of Bruce Pritchard playing the real Rogers character as their not-so-subtle shot at Dusty Rhodes, and just playing a really awful Dusty Rhodes as one of their announcers. And this set up the title match at WrestleMania with the ladder. And the fact that they went all over the place doing these ladder matches at house shows, which preceded that, and also coming out of it as well. I mean, they did who knows how many of these ladder matches altogether, and 95% of them were not on TV.
Yeah, like, because I always knew Bret and Shawn had ladder matches prior on the house.
They did one in 92, I believe.
Right. And so I suppose they didn't think much of the ladder match stipulation initially, because why wouldn't they have put it on TV earlier than this if they were doing so many matches dark like at house shows?
Yeah, well, it always seemed that the Michaels Hart one, which was done and tape for Coliseum Video was just almost like a test to put this out there. And the story had always been, it was Brett's idea pitching that because they had done ladder matches in Stampede. And they did the ladder match, and then it ended up being Michaels and Hall that would get to do the ladder match at WrestleMania. And then after that, it was kind of Shawn Michaels got credited with this when it was sort of Brett's idea, at least from his side, that pitched this and the ladder matches that preceded it in Stampede.
I think it's a great idea to have like a house show specific stipulation match, or you know what I mean? Like to debut possibly new stipulation matches at house shows before you get them ready for TV. You know, kind of like how a comedian would rehearse a set before getting it ready for TV.
Yeah, I don't know how the guys would feel about doing rehearsals of ladder matches all over the house shows, but nonetheless, they did it for this one, and that was, you know, one of the matches that kind of defined that era for the WWF, one of their best shows of all time with Brett and Owen, and then this ladder match. And they don't really, they never talked about the rematch, though, the SummerSlam match they did a year and a half later, which was another great ladder match, but they only focused on WrestleMania here because it was then kind of Razor Ramon was in this great babyface spot. They showed all the different promotional stuff he was involved with, including dressed up as Santa Claus for a drinking and driving awareness ad, doing promos, video games, and appearing on the Jerry Springer Show way.
Yeah, this was a very, this was a big surprise to me, this segment in the show, and how much
I had never seen this.
They focused on it and how much they got out of this. So,
on the Jerry Springer Show, they had these two kids who had been diagnosed with AIDS, and they were wrestling fans, and then Scott Hall shows up in his gear.
They were wrestling fans, and in particular, this one kid, his favorite wrestler was Razor Ramon.
Yeah, so as a surprise for these kids, they brought in Razor Ramon, who had the Intercontinental title, and ended up giving them this pep talk about not being defeated by this disease, and then gave them the Intercontinental title. And he told them to share it.
He gave them the title, like, he decided at that point. He didn't even get permission prior. It was just, he called an audible and decided, hey, you know what? This feels like it's a really nice moment. I'm just going to hand the title to these kids. And to actually hear that story, and to hear Jerry Springer be interviewed in this, because he's, of course, a part of the network now, was really cool. And to hear Razor talk about how, you know, he had to call Vince afterwards and say, hey, Vince, I'm going to need a new title at the next show because I gave this to the kids. And, like, to hear Vince's reaction that he wasn't upset. In fact, he applauded Scott Hall for making the right choice and doing that at that time. This was a really cool story and beautifully retold here with all the footage from Springer and even an interview with Jerry Springer himself, which I didn't expect.
Yeah, a feel-good moment on the Jerry Springer Show in whatever year this would have been, 95?
Yeah, I think at 95 it probably
94, 95.
Started to degenerate. But, I mean, for a long time, I think Springer was just like your typical, you know, Sally, Jesse, Raphael talk show.
So we then go to 1996, and Hall's noting how he wasn't happy that his pay had kind of just plateaued in the company, and it led to him giving his notice, and he had originally gone to Vince McMahon saying, how can I get my pay to be with the top guys? And wasn't happy with whatever came out of that. And then the week after he gave his notice, it was Kevin Nash who gave his notice, and Nash was stating he just wanted the WWF to match what WCW was putting on the table, and the WWF couldn't do that. And this was good because they also did have Vince McMahon chime in here and even admit that it was probably a mistake, the fact that he let them go at the time, and how different the industry would have been if those two had not left, and and the idea of the NWO wouldn't have presented itself. It would have been a very hard angle to kick off without those two involved. And it would have been very different. And how the WWF would have necessarily grown with Hall and Nash in the mix, wouldn't Austin have risen to where he did when you had those extra bodies there in top positions?
Would the Attitude Era have ever needed to occur if you didn't have the competition from the NWO and WCW? So it's really cool to hear Vince talk about something like that here, expressing regret for not matching Nash and Hall's money that they're offering. And I feel like, you know, Vince doesn't appear on all these DVDs. Like, I don't... Did he appear on the Bischoff one?
I think just with some...
maybe some older interviews?
Yeah, and this one, too, is probably, you know... They did one big interview with Vince, and then they kind of just sprinkle in clips. I mean, I'm sure this was stuff from the Monday Night War series as well.
But, you know, very revealing words from Vince that I'd like to know if Scott Hall even was aware of, you know, Vince's regret.
Mm-hmm. So with all of that done, it was DDP who, once again, helping out his buddies, pitched Hall and Nash to Bischoff, and that's when Vince said that both sides made mistakes at the time, and they were offered guaranteed money in WCW, and he was not willing to upset their contract structure at the time in order to keep those two. And I think, honestly, for the good of the company, I think those two leaving kind of opened that up. I think one of the big keys to the WWF exploding in 98 was you had all of these fresh guys in top positions with Shawn and Brett gone, and you had these brand new stars in the fans' eyes, like talent they had not seen on top for years and years. So we showed some highlights of the curtain call from May 19th. Thankfully, they didn't...
No, this was already covered in far more depth on the Click Rules DVD.
Yeah, exactly. And then Hall showing up on the May 27th edition of Nitro, which we recently reviewed that you can go check out in the archives. And then we got the interview with Hulk Hogan discussing the formation of the New World Order and some of Scott Hall's ideas for it as well at this point. And, of course, there was the lawsuit filed by the WWF when Hall and Nash came in and were insinuating they were coming on behalf of the WWF and led to Bischoff having to ask them point blank on television if they worked for the WWF. And we got some awesome footage of Scott Hall's deposition. And
this was great.
Oh, this was some of the best stuff on the whole documentary.
Like, I can't believe that. I can't imagine how large that video library is in Stanford. The fact that they would have a tape even of this, of Scott Hall's deposition from this intellectual property trial.
These guys That's don't tape nuts. Over anything. They save everything.
It's insane.
Oh, and he's talking about, I mean, the lawyer, the prosecution has him in this, like, they're trying to wrangle him to explain this, the Razor Ramon character and how it's linked to Tony Montana. And you can just see Hall, like, squirming with his answers. And then it cuts to him.
Squirming and, like, almost like being, you know, like playing heel. Like, you know, like you can't do anything to me.
But the highlight is when he looks into the camera and waves and says hi to Vince.
Yeah.
This is just awesome. I had never seen this footage before, and I would love to watch this entire deposition.
Oh, man. Yeah, and it's incredible that they found this.
They also went over and addressed the fake Razor and fake Diesel, that awful idea the WWF had.
Yes, and Scott Hall said he was really flattered by it all.
And Vince's idea, he was saying at the time, I just believed I could just recreate these characters. They were my characters. And essentially saying, like, the people playing them meant nothing to me. I had the belief I could just recreate these characters. I mean, it was amazing. And then, the backstory way of Hey Yo. And they even got footage from Rocky II of Sylvester Stallone as Rocky using the term Hey Yo. And this was just classic WWF editing with Scott Hall describing the scene verbatim. And then they had the footage from Rocky II.
Yeah, and again, just like the amount of legal work that it must have taken to get this 3-second clip cleared from Rocky. It must have been a headache, but I think it shows the level of quality and care put into this production. They got possibly everything they could have visually.
WCW is not a big part of this documentary. The most part of the WCW tenure for Scott Hall is spent on the fall of 1998 when Scott was a mess. And they decided to make all of his drinking problems his character, where he was showing up drunk and said it wasn't a fun time. And Vince was saying that had he stayed in the WWF, this would not have happened. And Bischoff as well is asked about this. And I mean, to his credit, he admits he completely knew he was taking advantage of a guy for his own television. He's not proud of this, but he completely approved it. He didn't try to pass it off to someone else's idea, which typically happens in these kinds of situations in pro wrestling. It's just, oh, it wasn't on my watch. But Bischoff owns this, and this was completely exploitive at the time and just done in such bad taste for a guy that was legitimately in and out of rehab sessions and was a mess in 1998.
You had Cody asked about this too.
Yes.
And he obviously seemed uncomfortable even talking about it in this interview, saying how, you know, I guess, you know, it was interesting at the time, but he felt he didn't like it so much because he didn't even know if his dad was acting or if it was real, because it reminded him of a lot of real situations where he saw his dad at home in.
Yeah, this was awful to hear from his kids who were watching this. And it was also notable how Scott, throughout this documentary, when he's talking about his kids, saying he felt he was a good father, but really wasn't good at being a husband. And I think it's pretty notable at all the people interviewed here that his ex-wife, Dana Hall, is not spoken to at all in this documentary. And I'm sure this project seems like something like they would have wanted her perspective in all of this. Mm. But she is not in this. So Shawn Michaels then, as they're talking about Scott's problems, they kind of had this agreement where they would only live this lifestyle when they were on the road. But the problem was they were always on the road, and it led to all of these problems, which, I mean, Shawn Michaels went through his problems, Scott Hall went through his problems, Waltman did, and typically it was, you know, Hunter and Nash who were kind of the guy, especially Hunter, who was the guy that did not drink, that were kind of the guys that were helping out their friends at this point in time. But just, you know, it was a lot of factors that led to this, and that's kind of where it leads into, of just how messed up Scott Hall was. And this was something that for years he was just someone that you were, sadly, you were expecting to just one day read about.
But this wasn't even the worst of it.
No. They just skipped from there to 2002 when he came back for that brief return, working with Steve Austin at WrestleMania and getting let go shortly afterwards. And they brought up when he had first come back that he was on these pills that would make him violently ill if he was in contact with alcohol.
You're saying that Jake was taken in the resurrection.
Yes.
Jake the Snake, yeah.
And, I mean, they show the very scene of Austin pouring beer all over him in an angle, which I think that was pretty awful and irresponsible thing to book a guy in.
Definitely.
Like, it was just purely fucking with a guy.
That was really bad. I'm sure the company would express a lot of regret over that kind of lack of care. And it was actually a little revealing that they would even include that on this DVD, considering.
Yeah, because that makes the company look, I thought, pretty insensitive here, that they had booked him in this. And going back to that WrestleMania match, the original idea was they wanted Scott Hall to win, and it was Austin who wasn't really down for that. And you know what? He was right, because this guy didn't last much longer. He was in February and gone by May. So shortly after the draft that we just reviewed. And Vince said that during this time, he was just a shell of a performer at this point in 2002. And that would turn out to be his last run with the company as in terms of an in-ring performer.
Yeah, in fact, if you even look at the list of matches that are included in the DVD, this was the last match that was included.
The WrestleMania match.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think, you know, I remember being a fan at the time in 2002 and hearing about the NWO coming in, and I think we had all known Scott Hall had these issues, but I suppose as fans we all expected him to have kind of everything handled when he made his return to the WWE, but I think in hindsight it was clear that the guy wasn't ready for such a high-profile spot. Like a match with Steve Austin at WrestleMania at this time.
No, you know, being on the road and that schedule, probably the worst thing for the guy in 2002. And came in with a lot of baggage, and there was a lot of unrest in the locker room when the NWO was brought in, and just all the issues that had been discussed with WCW. It's like, why are we bringing these guys into our locker room? That was a very big sentiment at the time in 2002. So not much is discussed over the next 10 years, essentially. Nothing about his time in TNA, not surprising. And they go over his various arrests through 2012, showing different mugshots. And Kevin Nash is very much featured here, as he was the guy constantly trying to help him and get him into the WWE's rehab program. And Scott Hall here, he's with the NXT talent, saying that he had 12 inpatient rehab stints altogether. And Hall mentions not dealing with the root problem, and instead it was always dealing with the side effects of the root problem, which was the murder in 1983. And the side effects were the drinking and the pills that came from that. And Michaels, this was a really, I thought, introspective look just into a number of these wrestlers. And he mentions how they only dealt with one another. Even these guys, who appeared to be as close as possible, they only dealt with one another on the surface. They never went deeper than that. And Nash was explaining how Scott Hall was a very religious guy, and he had it set in his mind that he was going to hell as a result of the murder. And I thought this was some really captivating stuff from his friends, and kind of being very honest about, we were best friends, but it was a limit to how open we were with one another, and dealing with this traumatic event that Scott lived with.
Yeah, for sure.
Then it continues, and Paul Levesque is interviewed, and he had been instructed not to speak to Hall whenever Hall would call, because Levesque represented a connection to the business. And they go over Shawn Michaels' induction in the 2011 Hall of Fame ceremony, and Nash and Waltman coming out there and no Scott Hall, and the fact that Hall was actually invited to do it, and it was Hall who said he was just he couldn't be around that kind of environment, and the fact that Michaels was looking at it as a positive, that he was at least aware of what he could not handle at that point. But that was, I remember, an interesting point during 2011. It was very noticeable, Scott Hall's absence there with the other members of the clique for Michaels' induction. And then we go to the rock bottom point, which was just a few weeks after that Hall of Fame induction, when, and this was the big subject for that ESPN feature, was Hall's appearance for Top Rope Promotions, where he comes out wrecked. Like, this looks like a corpse being wheeled out to perform. It was one of the most sad displays you have ever seen of any performer. He was not even there. Like, his eyes, his body, like, just a vacant look on his face throughout this. This was just hard to watch, looking at this guy. And it was frightening.
Hard to watch, and makes you wonder, wow, who would put the guy out there in the condition that he was in? But at the same time, perhaps this footage is what was required for the wake-up call that hopefully he ultimately got from this.
Yeah, and that was brought up here. I mean, Kevin Nash, who had probably been as close to him as anybody, was preparing for a funeral for this guy.
I think the wrestling world was, you know?
I think there was a time when it was Scott and Jake were just,
yep.
It's sad, but it wouldn't have shocked anybody at that time. So it was Sean Waltman who reached out to Diamond Dallas Page, who had been working with Jake Roberts, and he was fearful that Hall was going to kill himself. And they end up reaching out to him, and they showed the footage, which was also in the Resurrection documentary, of Jake and Page calling him. And eventually, you know, Hall is at rock bottom at this point. He talks about how he's just drinking vodka for breakfast, and he agrees to come out to...
This was all footage from the Resurrection of
yes.
Jesus' name.
Yeah. And just picking him up at the airport when he was 300 pounds. His hip was a mess. The Indiegogo fundraiser they did, raising $109,000 for his hip surgery. And just talking about what a turnaround Page made for this guy and getting him to be mobile, losing weight, and going for surgery for his hip as well. And
yeah, it really is incredible to see the transformation caught on tape, where, you know, I'm sure this is a process that took months, but, you know, in a matter of seconds, you got to see him go from a wheelchair to starting to stand up and trying to do yoga with a bunch of chairs to doing yoga without the use of any chairs and being far thinner than before. And I also thought it was really nice to see Jake Roberts interviewed here and speak from the role of the caregiver when he himself was, you know, obviously somebody that we all thought was in the same situation as Scott Hall.
And Paige had actually called Hunter in 2013 and threw the idea of the Hall of Fame out. And Hunter said that, well, they've got to stay clean. Let's give it another year. They weren't ready to just sign off on them being completely recovered at this point. And then he got the Hall of Fame call in 2014, and they show him arriving in 2014 in New Orleans for his Hall of Fame ceremony. And he compliments the cameraman who's following him as Hall is walking in. And Hall, even here, he gets his digs in on WCW, saying, "You're really good. I was used to those WCW cameramen stumbling all over the place." I mean, just any opening to just take those shots at WCW, it just seemed they were more than willing to take.
Yeah.
And this is where he goes over the fact that he was invited in 2011, but it declined for the Michaels induction. And we get Hall's speech, and it was cool to see the Click's reactions backstage. These guys just seemed like fans, and it's like Hall hit his big go-home line at the end, and they were just so happy for this guy, who looked night and day from the guy they picked up at the airport. I mean, to this, where he's tanned, he's lost weight, and had a great speech that year when we were there at the Hall of Fame.
Just seemed fully awake and present.
And Hall also admitted here that he isn't where he needs to be. He knows he's going to fall again, but he's in a better spot than he was before. And then Nash cites that there's shorter binges than before, which I appreciated the honesty that this wasn't something that he's just completely recovered from a lifelong struggle with addiction, that there still are stumbles. They're not trying to just sugarcoat this recovery into this perfectly nice ending to a story. There's still a struggle involved in all of this. And I like the fact they added that. And it finishes off just with more stuff at the Performance Center, where I laughed out loud at the one comment. I think it was with Baron Corbin, where Hall just looks at him and says, "What's that string coming out of your shirt?" "Oh, it's your arm. You fell for it." I mean, this guy has a great wit about him. And I think a lot of times in his history, that would just rub people the wrong way. I mean, he always had the famous line about asking guys what their finish is, and when the guy would say it, says, "Yeah, can't wait to kick out of it." And I think many people took it the wrong way. This guy's just like he's kind of a dick, and I think most people have been around him will fully admit that.
Sure, or it could just be him joking around.
Well, they talk about Cody at the end, that they're roommates now, helping him train, does mention him working in New Japan, and then talking about his daughter Cassidy, and again, goes over just being a father for them at this point. And the documentary ends with these old Scott Razor Ramon promos in front of a green screen with the updated version of him today, and they just cut back and forth with the green screen to end the documentary. So that was it. That was the Scott Hall story, Wei. Your overall thoughts?
Oh, man. Well, I think the best stories are redemption stories, and here you know this documentary kind of played out like a match. You had the baby faces shine with his rise to fame as Razor Ramon and the NWO, and then you had the heat and the alcoholism and, you know, stumbling into the ring at the indie show, and then you had this big comeback with DDP Yoga, dealing with the psychological issues, and finishing at the Hall of Fame. I thought it was a really good documentary because the guys lived an incredible life of very intense ups and downs, and I feel like in an hour and 20 minutes you really got a very good, concise, and complete glimpse of that entire process. He comes across like a really sympathetic and likable guy, and you start to really feel for him when, you know, it's identified that his sense of guilt that's followed him his entire adult life was the reason for a lot of his problems. So he's a very good speaker. He seems to speak very
tremendous
openly
speaker,
and honestly, like a lot of wrestlers are. The amount of interviews that they collected seemed very vast and complete. Of course, you had the Click, but you also had Vince here talk about him in an updated interview. And the amount of footage that they seemed to grab from every source they could for this thing was really appreciated as a viewer. I mean, just even, again, that three-second Rocky clip, which must have been a legal nightmare to try to clear, and the use of that Jerry footage and the DDP footage, and they seem to really go the extra distance to get everything for this one.
Yeah, tremendous speaker Scott Hall is, and a guy that, to a person that has worked with him, always credit just how smart this guy is with the little things in the industry, not even touched upon in this documentary, is a popular story of the fact that he largely came up with the Crow Sting character as well. So he's somebody that I think is a tremendous value in a performance center environment.
And a public speaking environment.
And this is a guy whose life is professional wrestling. I mean, it's just something that consumes him, and it was a very well done story, I thought. So I enjoyed the documentary quite a lot, and yeah, echo a lot of the points that you just outlined. So I give this documentary an 8 out of 10.
I give it an 8.5.
Wow, 8.5. So now we'll go to the Law message board and get some feedback from you. We start off with Kevin from San Antonio. I just finished watching the documentary, and I have to say it was really well done. Not surprised by this, though. I've heard Hall on podcasts before tell some of the stories covered, but for WWE to have footage of some or having Scott on location was really cool. It was also really interesting to see the phone call DDP and Jake made to Scott before he came in. After seeing the part about Scott on Jerry Springer, I looked it up on YouTube, and that was very touching. I never knew he was on the show. Can't wait to go through all the matches and relive my childhood. My question, when were these interviews taped, and was there ever any idea of not including Hulk Hogan in the final cut? Thanks again for the copy of the DVD from the giveaway a couple weeks back. I think a lot of these were done specifically for the Scott Hall one, and I think, I mean, Hogan was limited to, I think, like one answer maybe?
One clip, yeah.
Which I don't see what the big deal is.
He was not, I mean, I felt like you got enough out of Hogan for that portion. The NWO portion itself wasn't really focused on all.
No, and that's where really, I mean, Hogan, of what they chose to focus on, Hogan wasn't really involved in a whole lot of that.
You actually had Hogan, though, talking about the moment when Austin was pouring beer all over him.
Yes.
Hogan was actually the one to bring up that criticism.
That's right, that's right.
Okay, we got an MJ from NJ who says, I haven't seen the DVD, so thanks for summarizing it. Okay, well, he has
thanks
his thoughts.
For the feedback.
It's really something that some of the greatest characters in wrestling have had negative impacts on the real person portraying it. I had read rumors Taker suffered from depression after some of his darkest runs, and here Hall really wound up being the bad guy. I think Hall and Nash's images have deteriorated over the years, but history should always remember that it was getting over such captivating characters like Razor that created the buzz and momentum for the Monday Night Wars.
Let's go to Andrew from Erie, Ontario. First time post. I just finished watching the documentary and was wondering when this podcast was going to be posted until I found out it's Fridays now. I liked how WWE produced the documentary. I wasn't expecting anything different. I remembered watching the ESPN feature on E60 when he went on the low point of his life before his time with DDP Yoga. Thought he was going to talk about his WrestleMania 31 appearance with the NWO and taking that back body bump on the floor. Loved listening to you guys. Keep up the great work. And question, I noticed how the New Japan shows have been preempted and we're not getting any recent content with JR and Josh Barnett commentary. Any update on the show and when does it usually air on the Fight Network? Well, we're going to be going over the schedule before the end of the program today about when you can catch all the wrestling programming on Fight Network. Yeah, that was a bit of something that they didn't show was WrestleMania 31 with the run-ins with the NWO and DX for the
right.
Hunter Sting match.
Yeah, that's true. I suppose they could have because that was who got inducted. Was that
The Nash year?
That was the Nash year. Well. Yeah, I'm guessing they just decided to end on the Hall of Fame as, you know, kind of the high point.
That was a crazy bump he took at WrestleMania. For a guy with hip surgery and taking a back body drop.
All right, final piece of feedback. John from Plainfield, Illinois. First of all, I want to say thanks to Way and John as I watched the DVD that I won through the Raw Reveal Way
contest. We've got every winner with feedback here.
Thank you for sending your feedback in anyway. So in an industry where there are so many ultimate untimely deaths related to substance abuse, it was great to see Hall recover from hitting rock bottom and get his life back on track. The footage from the indie show was tough to watch as there were scenes where DDP and Jake As were the scenes where DDP and Jake reached out to him over the phone when he had been taking vodka all day, and then later when they picked him up from the airport and he showed up in a wheelchair. It's amazing that he was able to go from those lows to the highs of being inducted into the Hall of Fame, being invited to speak to young wrestlers at the Performance Center, and even taking a bump on the floor at WrestleMania 31. I was surprised to see a WWE production cover so much dark subject matter. And then again, you can't really tell Scott's story without it.
All right. Well, thank you, folks, for the feedback. And before we get on out of here, we're going to announce what we're reviewing in 2 weeks' time. But we did want to mention there's a lot of wrestling content now on the Fight Network, and we want to bring everyone up to speed on what is airing and when it's airing. So if you have Fight Network in Canada, here's the rundown. On Tuesdays, you've got Review a Raw at 7 p.m., the highest-rated show ever.
On cable television.
That's the lead-in for CMLL at 8, which is followed by TNA Explosion. And then we've got Ring of Honor Tuesday nights at 10, and then New Japan Tuesday nights at 11. So your whole night is solid.
Yeah. So
don't worry about that other Tuesday night wrestling show.
If you were to watch the other Tuesday night wrestling show, you can flip over to Fight Network and catch Ring of Honor and New Japan Pro Wrestling right after.
Wednesday nights, these are late nights on Wednesday. We have Insane Championship Wrestling, followed by British Weekly Wrestling, and then AAA. So that starts off at 1 a.m. Eastern late Wednesday night, which is 10 p.m. Pacific if you're on the West Coast, for all of our listeners in Van City. Mm-hmm. Thursday nights, Impact has moved on Fight Network to reflect the Pop TV move, so it's on Thursdays at 8, followed by TNA's Greatest Matches at 10, Wrestle Center Voltage from our friends out in Halifax, Nova Scotia. That airs at 11 Eastern. And then Paragon Pro Wrestling out of Las Vegas airs Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern time. And that also replays Tuesday afternoons. If you have Fight Network outside of Canada, you can go to fightnetwork.com and see the schedule. That is pretty much the lineup for the Canadian version and our international version of the channel. U.S., it's slightly different because of existing contracts some of these promotions have, such as ROH and New Japan. But a number of those promotions also air in the U.S. as well. How did I do?
Did great.
Wonderful. Way, next week, it will be Bauer and Pollock, and then 2 weeks from this Friday, you and I are back, and you and I are going to spend this summer living in the past, in the year 2000.
Oh, yes, because we were on our way to look at SummerSlam, because it's almost SummerSlam season. This year, we're going to look at the year 2000, and the lead up to SummerSlam 2000, we will be talking about Fully Loaded. Fully Loaded 2000 featuring a world title match involving Chris Benoit and The Rock, who's the champion. Triple H takes on Chris Jericho in a last man standing match. You have The Undertaker taking on Kurt Angle. What else you got?
Eddie Guerrero and Perry Saturn, as I recall.
Yes, and you also have Val Venus versus Rikishi.
Oh, man.
The Dudley Boys versus Lowdown. The Hardy Boys and Lita taking on TNA with Trish, even.
I think that was Jason Agnew's match of the year that year between Rikishi and Val Venus.
Is that right?
Yes.
Wow.
So there you have it. That is our review coming up in 2 weeks' time. The date of that, Friday, August the 5th, when we will be back. I've now got to check dates to make sure everyone knows when we will be back.
We'll get used to it.
Yes.
But everybody, you can hear from us, the two of us. Oh, you can hear from John on Sunday night on The Law.
Correct. We'll have a packed show on Sunday. Battleground review. We're going to chat about all the TV this week with the draft, all the moves, tons of stuff coming up Sunday night. And then Way and I are back Monday night with Review of Raw, Tuesday night with Review of SmackDown, and we will chat with you later on.
I learned that when I stepped through that curtain, that I could have a relationship as a performer with an audience. And it was a powerful thing to me, whether I was the hated villain or the beloved hero. And that was something that I've always treasured. So thank you to all the wrestling fans here. And all the fans watching around the world. in my lifetime, I've learned. Hard work pays off. Dreams come true. Bad times don't last, but bad guys do.